This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When America was young, the West was a wild frontier. People talked of its bounty and promise, but without a path to follow, making that trip was just a dream. That all changed when fur trappers and traders laid the groundwork for the Oregon Trail, a 2,200-mile route that began in Missouri and snaked its way through the prairies and mountains to the valleys of Oregon. The trail united the coasts and doubled the size of the country. In the 15 years leading up to the Civil War, nearly 500,000 people packed up their covered wagons and followed that trail in what scholars refer to as the largest land migration in history. These days, the Oregon Trail is splintered, with many parts overgrown, paved over, and all but forgotten. Our guest Rinker Buck decided to do what no one has done in more than a century: cross the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon. Rinker Buck is a journalist and writer and was longtime staff writer for the Hartford Courant and is the author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Rinker, I'm so glad you came in.
Great. Thanks for being here.
Well, I'm really glad you're with us. So what, by the way, prompted you to embark on such a potentially perilous journey?
Well, it's kind of a case, I think, of what makes you think I'm crazy makes me feel comfortable, you know. But what happened was I became fascinated with the Oregon Trail about 6 or 7 years ago, and I started reading up on it. And what moved me so much was how much the trail experience reminded us of the country we have today, and that the history that was important was not the history that had been taught to us in schools. So women played a very important role in the trail. Religious schisms and all kinds of America was a very, very divided and contentious religious place in the 19th century. Religion played a very big role. It wasn't one trail. It was really a collection of trails. So all of these things were fascinating to me. And then as I'm studying the trail, I come across this sentence: the last documented crossing of the Oregon Trail was in 1909. And I go, yeah, but I mean, I'm a horse guy. That's the book. That's what I'll do. And so it becomes a question of whatever is eccentric or whatever is different about your childhood or your past. It empowers you. It enables you to go out and do something that other people wouldn't think to do. I had the self-confidence to know that I could get there. Now, then I got out on the trail and it was a disaster, but, you know.
But that makes a great book, and it's also a little bit memoir. You are one of 11 children. You took one of your brothers with you on the trip, your youngest brother, Nick, who couldn't seem more opposite, which made you kind of an odd couple on the road.
I understand you come from a large family, too, so you know what I'm about to talk about. You know, it's like, you know, I love my brother, but, you know, he's sort of working class and blue collar and...
And rather potty mouthed.
Yeah, that's the polite way to say it. Potty mouthed. I have to start using that. And I'm, you know, I'm sort of the pretentious older brother, you know, who has a college education and likes antiques and fine wine, you know. And if we had a day when we had to fix the wagon, I would offer to help him fix the wagon, you know, because we broke our wheels a lot and things fell apart. And he'd go, I don't want your college educated butt anywhere near this wagon, you know. So it's also a story of brothers.
Well, you initially had planned on making the trip alone. Now, why didn't you?
I just thought I could do it alone. I didn't have anybody that I knew would come along. I figured I could do it myself. I had all kinds of imagination of myself riding a nice horse and leading the team of mules that pulled the wagon by a lead line and all this kind of thing. And immediately, instantly, within 2 hours of being on the trail, but especially at night when we had to make camp and take the harness off, bathe the mules, all that kind of stuff. It's Daniel Boorstin called, the historian Daniel Boorstin called the covered wagon plainly a community vehicle. It needed groups of people in order to work, and that's why they had the wagon trains. So very quickly into the trip, I realized how lucky I was that my brother was available to come on the trip, and he's a much better team driver and mechanic than I am.
Well, why not do it in a truck or an RV with a shower? I mean, were you trying to prove something here?
I wasn't trying to. The history drove it. But I also like the sort of narrative cocoon that I created by riding by in a covered wagon 150 years after the pioneers went. You're still seeing the same things, and you're also seeing different things, and it was fascinating. I mean, one thing I discovered that's just fascinating is, so in eastern Kansas and Nebraska, which are relatively habited, we would come to places where children would run to the end of their driveway with apples and buckets of water for the mules. And we would stop the wagon. After a while, we kind of were dodging them, but because we wanted to make progress. But we would stop the wagon and talk to the kids and everything. And I started to notice that the parents were the wrong age. The parents were all very old. And so I finally asked one of the parents, and there's a whole generation of children out in the West, Midwest, being raised by their grandparents because their biological parents, the sons and daughters of the grandparents, have spun off on, they would say to me, it was the recession and meth, you know. And, of course, methamphetamine is quite an epidemic out there.
Right, out in the West.
And then when I got back, I looked it up, and there was this huge spike in demographics. It was one of three major changes in the demography of the country that the Census Bureau pointed out between 2000 and 2010 census. And I encountered it all across the West. There's, I think it's something like 12 million children now being raised by their grandparents.
That's unbelievable.
Now, you asked me, why didn't I take a minivan? Okay.
Right.
Well, nobody's going to run out for apples for your minivan.
Right.
You know, it was so ironic. By plodding along with a team of mules and an authentic covered wagon at 4 miles an hour, I actually saw more of my country today. I was riding a sort of a social observation point than I would have if I sped along the highway in a car.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Plus, the country's beautiful from a while.
Well, is it all still passable? I mean, must be private property in a lot of parts of the Oregon Trail. Were you able to cross it all?
Yes, we crossed it all. There were a few places in Idaho where they put in irrigation canals that really made it. If I had to do the trip over again, I would have carried a little portable bridge. But yes, about half of the trail is now paved over mainly into small blacktops, you know, something like Route 9 in New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
Two-lane blacktops. And I didn't mind that at all because that's history. The road that the pioneers took turned out to be the best route somewhere. So about half of the 2,000-mile trip was on paved roads. And then another 1,000 miles was just beautiful old dirt roads right along the Platte River. And in Wyoming, there's 350 miles, and we took every inch of it, of original ruts down through beautiful places. And it's also a portrait of the generosity of the country and how it is out West now. You know, we camped in rodeo corrals. We camped on ranches. We camped a couple times on golf courses and stuff like that. So the trail's all that's still there, and the spirit is still there.
How long did it take in the end for you and Nick?
It took 4 months. You're going from Missouri to Oregon through six big Western states. And we made 79 camps. You know, we camped 79 times. So,
I'm speaking with a longtime journalist and author, Rinker Buck, about his new book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. It is part family memoir, and it's part travelogue, and it's part history, and part dispelling the myths of history, one being that it was dominated by men. But you, Rinker, discovered otherwise. Tell us about this woman, Narcissa Whitman.
So Narcissa Whitman was a classic product of early 19th century America, which was that she was there was a great evangelization movement early in the century called the Second Great Awakening. And so she became converted, and on her conversion moment, you know, when she was born again, she had a vision that she had been placed on earth by God to evangelize the Indians out West. To make the story short, basically, she found another missionary who was dying to go out West. He had already traveled out West, Marcus Whitman. She married him on the spot, basically. They basically had an arranged marriage and then fell in love on the trail. They got married and they left the next day to make this very perilous journey in 1836 across what is now the Oregon Trail. And it was a very significant journey because the big cultural bias against a trail crossing at that time in America was that women and children would not be able to make it. Mm-hmm. There was fur trappers out there, and those guys were kind of strange, and they'd marry into the Indians and stuff. But a white woman and kids, and you needed your wife and your children if you were going to file a claim and get free land out there. So Narcissa Whitman took the trip in a covered wagon. She was the first white woman to cross the Rockies. But what made it significant was her letters home to her family were published. And she said things like, oh, if you could see me today crossing the river in a canoe filled with all our trunks, you know. And she reassured America the rivers were safe, which was a very difficult thing in America at that time, and that the Indians were friendly. And they were initially.
So the Indians were friendly.
Yeah. Tragically, later on, after she settled in Oregon and everything, actually Washington State, but she was massacred by the Indians because being a missionary at that point was difficult. I'm pretty sure that's why she was forgotten to history. You know, you don't bring up someone like that and keep – but she – it was her letters home and how literate and laughing and fun they were, and the fact that she's falling in love with her arranged marriage husband as they go west, you know, mesmerized America and convinced Americans we could go on the trail. And then Marcus Whitman came back east one year and in 1843 led what was called the Great Migration. And it was the first big wagon train of about 1,000 people. Mm. And she's totally forgotten today. She had an immense impact on American history. So, yeah, I devoted a whole chapter to her in the book, and I found her quite – she was my guardian angel on the trail.
Any other revelations for you about how this trail forged not just a path west but a way of life in America?
Well, I think there were many other things, but we probably don't have time, but like the pioneers were terrible environmentalists and that kind of thing. You could literally by the late 1840s, early 1850s, you could navigate all the way to Oregon just by the debris pile.
Ugh.
It was America's sort of first...
first grade dumping ground.
Yeah, first grade dumping ground or a Superfund site. But all in all, it was a grand adventure. And one of the most fascinating things I read about in the book, I felt, was the cholera was very bad, of course, along the Platte River, and they didn't know how to cure cholera then. So you would sometimes pass 10, 15, 20 trail graves right beside the ruts. But what was amazing was, I quote, like Polly Coon and Amelia Jane Scott, and they would see all these graves every day, and there was so much suffering. They'd come into the camps at night, and people would be dying. But the countryside was so beautiful. Their journal would be full of the beauty of the country or Chimney Rock. And so this was a thoroughly American trait, that there was a romance, there was a beauty, there was something larger than itself drawing us across the plains to create a single continental mass. And we did that despite the horrible tragedy that they went through.
What do you think about having crossed the Oregon Trail and seen its significance in our country's history? Mm-hmm. Do you think there is, are you ready to lead a charge or call for renewed preservation of the trail?
Yes, and there's a significant efforts that way. But I have a sort of a mini essay within the book where I rage about the Tea Partyists and the people that, you know, everyone, taxes are too high and government spends too much. When you ride the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon, you camp almost every night at old campgrounds that became then called camp towns because people needed a place to stay for a few weeks until their land claim was approved by the government. Then they became resting places and big barracks and camps, the same place for soldiers in World War I and World War II. They became shanty towns during the Depression and so forth. And I just give the chain of provenance what happened, but it was federal government spending that kept these places open. And then during the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's WPA and CCC workers turned these into nice places with bathrooms and showers and stuff. Well, we camped almost every night at what was originally a pioneer campground and is now a beautiful state park or something like that. So the preservation has already happened. So, I kind of make a passionate argument for preservation. And I explain a lot. There's some wonderful characters in the book who, you know, they have an old ranch and there's a Pony Express stable on the ranch. And the rancher's getting old. It's always been in his family. He's kept it up. And now he just surrounded it in an implement shed so it's permanently preserved. Things like that. It's very touching. You get a sense of the country as a generous, open place. It was a very lyrical journey.
And a very lyrical book. I want to thank you so much for telling us more about it.
It was great being here. Thank you.
Rinker Buck, he's author of the new book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. And you'll find a link to read more about the book, including an exuberant review from the New York Times' Dwight Garner, all at wordofmouthradio.org.